Welcome to Health Hats, empowering people as they travel together towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen. I've worn many hats in my 40 plus years in healthcare as a patient, caregiver, nurse, informaticist, and leader. Everyone wears many hats, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities and healthcare's Tower of Babel. Let's make some sense of all of this.
Do you ever feel like you're part of someone else's play? Especially when you go to the doctor's office as a caregiver or caree. Caree is also known as a patient. You and your caregiver or caree feel like crap. You're exhausted. You're cranky. What are we doing here? The staff is unfamiliar. Really, they're strange. What are we going to accomplish with these strange people? I'm a nurse, I'm a patient expert, and a caregiver expert. Yet most of what I know and teach go right out the window when it's me in the doctor's office. It's 50-50 whether it's a good appointment or a shit show. I need different skills, an attitude adjustment, something, when I go to the doctor's office. I used to work at Boston Children's Hospital, where I led the Patient Family Experience Initiative. I took a class there from the clowns. They were known as the Big Apple Circus then and the Laughter League now. I wondered if we could learn some of what the clowns can teach us as patients and caregivers about relaxing, reading the room, figuring out what we're there to do, and not ending up more stressed than when you went in. And maybe even having a bit of fun. In this podcast, we will speak with Jason Stewart, a clown at Boston Children's, and listen in on a working session I led at the National Caregiving Conference in Chicago this past November, entitled Reading the Room and Yourself, Lessons We Can Learn from the Clowns When We Go to the Doctor's Office. Here's Jason. Let me introduce to you Jason Stewart, who is a clown at Boston Children's Hospital. I met Jay in 2010 when I led the Patient Family Experience Initiative, and I took a course that he taught called Reading the Room. I never forgot that day. I had thought going into the class that I was a really empathetic, sensitive person, but I have to say taking the class really upped my game. I became a better listener. It was my first introduction to mindfulness, even though I don't think the word mindfulness was used in the class. And it expanded my tools to be able to manage stressful situations. So welcome, Jay. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your journey becoming a clown at Boston Children's.
Okay. Sure. My story is kind of long. I'll try to give you the condensed version. I was in theater in college and kept getting cast as the comedy relief in all the shows I was in. And the directors, every time I would ask, can I do this? I said, Jay, go with your strengths. Jay, go with your strengths. And I said, well, okay. And then one of the directors that I really respected a lot said, Jay, you fall down well. You should look into physical comedy, clowning, and physical theater. And it really struck me, and I thought, well, okay, if he says that, then I'm going to check it out. And about that time, the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus came to town near where I was going to school, and there was an audition for the Clown College. And I thought, what is that? Because I had never really even seen a circus. And clown, to me, meant the guy that shows up at your kid's birthday party. You know, I didn't know anything more about that. Mm-hmm. But I got talked into it and went to the audition. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was a two-hour workshop of all kinds of improvisation and comedy and slapstick techniques and get up and show us what you got. Kid was the attitude, and I loved it. There was elephants in one ring, and there was people flying on the trapeze in the other ring. And right in the middle there we were with Clown Alley. And so I just said, you know what? If they'll take me, I'm doing this, because it was too great. So So I auditioned for the Clown College, and I got accepted. I was one of the lucky ones. It was a ton of people, and they would whittle it down to just 60 students at the time. And it was more like a boot camp than a college. We were there for 10 weeks, and it was 7 days a week, and you know, knocked yourself out all day long. So great training, though, has always carried me well. And at the end of the term, graduation was an audition to get onto the show. And I ended up back out on the road with those guys, same troop that had auditioned me. I joined that troop. And so in some ways, I kind of knew who they were. In some ways, they were these unapproachable heroes of mine. And then I began to realize, oh, we're like sort of the same tribe here. And I spent 2 years out on the road, and I knocked around 500 shows a year. It was great. About that time, I realized I needed to go back to school because I left grad school to go on the circus, and I was going to lose that degree if I didn't go back and get the thesis written. So I did that, left the road, and then I was asked to teach at the Clown College during the period of time. I was traveling all over the place. I was taking every gig that I could get to, you know, use my newfound love of clown, and then went overseas. I was in Japan with a circus. I came back to Ringling. I was the boss clown on The Greatest Show on Earth and writing gags and casting people and supervising the whole crew and blah, blah, blah. It went on and on. And so after my Ringling days were done, I met my wife through the circus. Our kids were born out on the road. We traveled for several years. And then when the kids got to be about school age, we decided to get off the road. And by hook or by crook, I ended up hearing about this team of performers and variety artists and clowns who were performing in hospitals. And I thought, wow, okay, well, it's a gig for a clown, right? So I'm going to audition for it. And I did, and it was here in at Boston Children's Hospital. And just by absolute fluke, I fell into this wonderful thing. And I said, okay, I'm a clown for 20 years. I've been all over the place, done a ton of things, but this is the hospital. And I went, wow, what am I going to do in there? You can't throw pies. You can't do a bunch of falling down, slapstick, you know, blowing things up like we did in the circus. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I need to really shut my mouth and learn something about what this is. I can't come in with these guys who have been here for, at that time, about 15 years. I can't walk in here and act like I know more than they do, because I may know a lot about clowning, but I don't know the venue. I don't know the style. I don't know what's required in that environment. So that was another one of the very smart decisions I made, was to realize you don't know anything. Come in as a newbie, come in as the new guy, and just learn. And so that's what I had to do. I kind of had this impression that the kids in the hospital were somehow some kind of different creature. There were some different species. Oh, it's a sick kid. And I was tiptoeing around and worrying that I was going to do something wrong. And then I realized, you know, Jay, it's just a kid who happens to be sick. Mm-hmm. The kid doesn't want you to come in and walk on eggshells and pat him on the hand and tell him he'll be okay. He wants you to be a clown for him. There's an expectation that comes with that nose and those big shoes. And the kid wants you to, you know, he doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want to be in the hospital. Nobody does, right? And so I learned quickly to not walk on eggshells and to not treat them as if they were some special case, you know, beyond what is required for the environment, but just to be a clown for them and to bust a joint up a little bit, because that's, I think, what every kid deep down kind of wants. And so this is now I'm into my 12th year performing at Boston Children's, and also down in Providence at the Hasbro Children's Hospital in Rhode Island. And, you know, I work two, sometimes 3 days a week. I'm in the hospital. It's an intense experience, but it's wonderful. And I do value it very much.
So I came out of that experience with you when I was at Children's a lot less afraid to fail, actually embracing failure. And I think that was something that you talked about in the course. Can you talk more about that, embracing failure in your work?
Sure. Yes. I always say that I have honed my craft of being a failure, because it really is what I think for comedy generally an audience wants.
Okay.
So failing is taking a chance, it's making a big choice, it's going beyond your comfort zone, and then not hitting the target. For me, the idea that the clown is in many ways a reflection of all of us. It's every man. There's been clowns in every culture. And because there's a need, a basic human need for that person, that entity in their world. The clown is the reflection of us all. And the clown can allow us to vicariously fail and to vicariously enjoy or feel good about ourselves, because here's somebody that we perceive as even a bigger failure than ourselves. So it's a way to laugh at ourselves, and by the clown making themselves vulnerable and making themselves the butt of the joke, the clown opens that door to our own insecurities and our own foibles and our own fear that we are losers. We are all of us losers. Any good comedian is a loser. And because the audience, the people that you're encountering, they want that. They want to see that subliminally that they are not alone as a loser. They can commiserate, and they can, at a subconscious level, kind of feel a bit superior and empowered by going, well, at least I'm not this guy. In the hospital, I feel like that's very pointed. It's very true that anybody who's in the hospital can probably use a laugh. And anybody who's in the hospital probably feels a bit like the failure. And when I say that, I mean subconsciously, the kid of any age, you know, not a little baby, but, you know, a kid who's gotten to a certain point, probably feels like they've done something wrong down deep because they're in the hospital. They aren't. Their normal world has altered, and it's everyone's paying all this attention to them and trying to do all this stuff, and they probably feel like they're not really succeeding in being a kid. The mom and the dad probably feel like failures because they couldn't keep their kid out of the hospital. They probably feel like, oh my gosh, did I do something wrong? Did I pass a gene on to this kid? Am I a failure? And so in this stew of bad emotion and fear and anxiety and feeling like a failure, in comes the clown. And I find that there is a level of, I don't want to say desperation, but just a very welcoming, oh, please come in here and do something for my kid. The way that people perceive what's going on in the hospital, there's tests and there's blood draws and there's all these medical discussions going on, and it's all very high stakes, and it's very high, you know, anxiety, and everybody gets their shoulders up under their earlobes and they can't breathe right. And then this, I find we come sailing in, we take that on, and we redirect, and we give them a good laugh, and hopefully when we're leaving, they take that breath and they can realize and say, hey, there's still good out there. There's still laughs and idiots who are willing to walk face first into a door and do all these ridiculous things for nothing other than just to give you a break so you can breathe again and just kind of go, okay, what's next? Mm-hmm. You know, I want to know, okay, now, whew, I feel okay, good. Feel a little more reset, balanced, and go. And a lot of that comes from the idea of these guys are failures. And they empower the kid. The kid is always smarter. The kid is always funnier, stronger, the better example. We need the kid's help. We need mom and dad's support. We need them. They can feel like they are helping us, even if it's just to accomplish the silly goals that we have set. Mm-hmm. And that in us being a failure, needing their help, subconsciously, that lifts them. And hopefully through a good laugh at the end, You set up something, you build it up, and you blow it off with a good laugh. Mm-hmm. We can leave them in a better place. What I consider a failure is if I go into that room and I don't have an effect. Mm-hmm. If I go in and it's kind of not a positive reaction or not mm-hmm. enough, I can't get through, if I can't bring them up, if mm-hmm. I can't leave them a little better off than I mean, you know, nobody bats 1,000. Mm-hmm. There's going to be rooms you go in and it's just ice cold and they're not going to engage. They're at the hospital. You can't blame them for that.
Right.
In some ways, it empowers them to be able to say no to us.
Okay.
They cannot say no to anything else in that environment.
The kid, The kid.
Yeah, the kid, even the parents. If they walk in, we got to do a blood draw. There's no parent that wants to hear that. Oh, you got to stick a needle in my kid's arm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. But they can't say no. They're not in control of their mm-hmm. experience right then. And they probably feel like a failure because of it.
Mm-hmm.
When we can come in and let them say no to us, they can, you know, in some ways mm-hmm. I feel like even the rejection of not today, clowns, we're not up for today, in a way that's an empowerment.
Yeah.
And if I see that as my failure, it's their win. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm there.
I hear a couple of things here. One of mm-hmm. them is that in my professional life as a patient caregiver expert or mm-hmm. as a nurse, I always thought that if I succeeded at everything, I didn't set my sights high enough. Failing means I tried something and it didn't work and I need to adjust. I need to learn from it and I need to try something different. I feel like managing your health is like that. You mm-hmm. you take a medicine, you get exercise, you change a habit, and sometimes it helps and sometimes it doesn't. Accepting that, it's such a shit show being sick. And being able to find the humor in the insanity, in the tragedy, in the disappointment, in the pain, is just helps deal with it.
I agree 100%. I always say that when I talk to the team, I always say, look, we work in the toughest environment there is, the hospital. I mean, mm-hmm. when I've done shows, I've worked in big circuses, I've done festivals, I've done stage work, I've done, you know, a lot of different things. But the audience is always kind of at a distance, and they're always sort of anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm coming out to present my routines and myself. Hospital is very different. There's no room for any of that, and there's no time for any of that. And it's a lot more about who you are and not what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I always say to the guys is, we're working in an environment where there's illness and anxiety and all these negative emotions and things, and even death sometimes. You have to say it. That's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's laughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a miracle in my mind. It's like, how can there still be that? And my brain boggles at the idea of the courage of these kids and families and the indomitable human spirit that is there,
mm-hmm.
that in the middle of all of that, they can still be wanting us to come in and break up the room and to laugh and to enjoy it and to be what I consider your best human. I feel mm-hmm. like laughter is when you're at your best, you know, to me, mm-hmm. is when you are the most human. Because laughter is like an autonomic response. It's not applause, mm-hmm. and it's not, gosh, wow, that was great.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real, authentic reaction to something that delights you.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we shoot our sights up to hitting that laughter, as opposed to just, oh, that was a nice song, or wow, cool trick, but when we can actually get to what I consider autonomic response, like mm-hmm. breathing or swallowing. You don't think about, once you've swallowed something, everything else happens by itself.
Mm-hmm.
When laughter's happening by itself, then you know you've done something.
Yeah.
So I always say, when we can be in that environment, and face what is a little bit we face it with them. Not like they're facing it, but we know where we're going. We know what floor we're on. We know what diagnosis this is going to be. We know a little bit about what's happening. Mm-hmm. And when we can go shoulder to shoulder and stand in there with them and say, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. They're still good. We're still laughing. We're still, you know, we're human.
And you're really stressed. The doctor is crazy busy. And sometimes when I go, I feel like I'm on stage and I have stage fright. And even though I'm a nurse and I'm an experienced person, all that goes out the window. And I think that I wish that I was better at improv. Things are just happening so fast. And so I'm wondering how we as lay people can use some of the skills you have as a clown and in improv to help make that doctor visit less stressful and more satisfying. So not so much like the technical, what are my questions and what's my plan, but helping to change the dynamic of those 5 minutes that you have with such high expectations.
I think you're onto something there, and it's human nature, I think, to assume that someone who's an expert in their field is somehow unapproachable and somehow should be treated differently. Mm-hmm. And so that raises the anxiety level. You're going to go see a doctor. You're going to go see someone who does things that you can't do. And it's someone who you have to turn to in this time of need. So of course you naturally are going to assume they're some kind of superhuman. And to me, that adds a level of stress to the encounter. When you go to the doctor, if there's any way to tell yourself and to make it feel real that this is just a guy or a woman, it's just another human being. I do think that we often skew things in our own minds to make it, oh, I'm not worthy of taking up this doctor's time. The improvisation side of that, the clown side of that, would be to, of course, I always come back to the equalizing power of laughter. I don't think that that's everyone's wheelhouse. Not everyone feels comfortable shooting for comedy, but if they can at least take to mind, this is just another person that's there. But the reverse side of that would be understanding that if you're going to see the doctor, when he goes home, he's going to sit on the couch and watch TV just like you do, probably. He's not some carved in marble Greek god from in the Parthenon or whatever. He's a guy. And you need to approach it in that way, I think, to just not feel so at sea, but just not to feel so lost, because we're all regular people down deep.
I think that humanizing is good. Sometimes when I work with caregivers and patients, they try to put a smile on their face, even if they're not necessarily feeling that, because they find that the other person, the professional, will mimic them. And that helps to diffuse some of the tension. I think a lot of this is about it's so tense.
We are all human beings with our subconscious mind. We're all reading nonverbal communication. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what that workshop was we did back in the day, was that idea of how can you read that to know how to respond in any given situation? What is the person telling you without saying it? What does their body language say? What is their expressions or the emotions that they're giving off? What does all that say? And it's all sort of subconscious and not something that they're choosing to communicate. But it is probably closer to the truth than whatever words they're choosing to express themselves. And so it's being, to me, part of our work as the clowns in the hospital is to read those nonverbal communication opportunities. That's the skill that I think the hospital clown develops because of the focus of our work. Mm-hmm. We aren't necessarily just trying to cure anything. You know, we're not there to see the charts and understand what this medication has done and what this mm-hmm. procedure may have helped with. We don't know any of that. Mm-hmm. We do know the spirit in the room. Mm-hmm. We do know the emotional values that are present in this unique room, because each room is different. Mm-hmm. Every room has different people in it and different people responding in different ways. It's an exhausting mental process for the clown. And everybody who does this work will tell you, by the end of the day, you're probably shocked. You've been at that heightened level of awareness, of mm-hmm. trying to read every little expression and every little body language type movement, and to see what you can do that's going to contribute, and instead mm-hmm. of detracting from, the last thing you want is to make it worse mm-hmm. for those folks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the old medical vow, you know, first do no harm. Mm-hmm. And that's us.
So I want to ask you one more question and then I'll let mm-hmm. you go. One of the things that I saw you guys doing that was really impressive to me was that you didn't just go into people's rooms. Sometimes you went with people to procedures, and the kids ended up needing either no or less pain medicine to get them through the procedure. So what's that about?
We don't go in there thinking that we can cure anything or that we're really going to be able to affect stuff medically. Mm-hmm. However, there is truth in the fact that the patient and family's emotional state will affect how things proceed. And so there's been a lot of evidence and a lot of attention shown to the idea of, you know, the human emotions are important, and laughter and the release of the stress release and the comfort level of the patient will dictate some of that. There's a group in Israel mm-hmm. that you actually get assigned, when it's a pediatric thing, the kid gets assigned a clown that works with the kid and before anything happens, and actually goes along through the stages of the procedure that they can be there for, and actually is, it's a whole different focus than what I think we are about, but there is evidence that that is of benefit. Mm-hmm. Now, we go into areas where it might surprise people, because we'll be asked, hey, we're trying to get, you know, this kid to hold still a minute, so we get an IV. Can you guys help us mm-hmm. With the distraction, with creating an experience where the kid will be able to focus on something else while we make these things happen? Now, we're not scrubbing in and going into an emergency room, operating room, or anything like that. But I do feel like we're part of a circle of care. In our way and how we can use our strengths, we can contribute. And often with stress reduction and with distraction and with raising emotional positivity, that it can contribute to things like needing less sedation or needing less painkillers later. Mm-hmm. Or there's truth in the fact that laughter releases endorphins, which, you know, lead to healing and to just lower blood pressure and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I'll take it that I'm sort of a medical person. Not really see myself as a doctor, mm-hmm. other than the fake name that I use when I'm clowning there at the hospital.
Hey, Jay, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Sure.
This has been really valuable. Isn't that great? I'd love to have a clown in my circle of care. Maybe my grandkids. Anyway, I spoke to Jay before I went to Chicago for the caregiving conference. That was before I was podcasting, so I didn't record that conversation. He helped me design the breakout session. Next, we'll hear that session. The audio is fair. We passed a microphone around. It took us a few seconds to get the mic to attendees as they spoke, and nobody was actually mic'd. so the volume is uneven. I led three exercises during the 15-minute session. Here's the beginning of the first exercise. In this exercise, I've asked three people to leave the room while the remaining participants non-verbally emote, first a positive emotion and then a negative emotion. We ask the people who left to come back in and guess what emotion is being emoted by the group. Okay, fine, folks. Here's a story. You're walking into a doctor's office. We are the doctor, all of us collectively. I want you guys to figure out what emotion are we emoting. Okay. What's that? Yes, relief. Good. So you go to the doctor's office and you come in and you see that there's this doctor who is relieved. What do you do with that? Well, how does that inform how you're going to handle whatever it is you plan for that visit when they're feeling relieved? Whenever you enter a room, this particular room is a doctor's office, and you're a caregiver and you're going with your caree, and you get this emoting the clinician, you have to integrate that into your whatever it is you're going to do in the visit. How do you do that? Yes, ma'am.
I guess because I'm a caregiver, I would be like, oh, wow, they seem to be comfortable in there, you know, so maybe I can be comfortable. But then my very next thought would probably go to what had them so worried to begin with. You know?
We did another round with the doctor emoting a negative emotion, condescension. The audio's pretty bad here. Attendees said that feeling condescension from the doctor put their hackles up. They wanted to give her the finger. They didn't like being talked down to. It puts their guard up. Okay, now back to the session.
It's disconnecting. That's what I feel. I got 5 minutes. I want to connect. But, you know, I'm spending four of it being pissed off. Doesn't help. The point of me doing this is that there's so much about managing a doctor visit that is not sort of technical and my list, you know, my goal, all the things that we're trying to accomplish. So this is the first one, which is the nonverbal of what you have to deal with because they're people. And they're coming in with something. Like, I know I love my primary care physician because she always comes in with this big smile. She's really glad to see me. And she sticks out her hand and says, Danny, I'm glad to see you. I'm just ready for business.
Another participant talked about micro expressions and their impact on the vibe of the room. Again, the sound is uneven and there's sounds of the mic being passed.
Your micro expressions, imitate them. And that's actually feedback to your own body about how you feel. So I think, you know, that experiment where they make people put a pencil between their teeth and it actually makes you feel happier. Well, yeah, because your mind takes its cues from your body. So when you mimic other people's self-expressions, you do actually feel what they're feeling. So I think there is something to forcing yourself, even when you see somebody coming at you like this. My husband's really good at this. I am not. I just get pissed and angry. But he'll go into high smile mode and really lay it on, because people actually then, if you smile at them and they're forced to smile back, basically, it actually changes their emotions too. So it changes your emotions to mimic them, but then it changes their emotions to mimic you. So you can actually work at changing that if you realize this person's in a pissed off mood, I'm going to be in a really good mood and like change their day and their emotions. Right, right. Right, because when they give people Botox, they actually have a harder time reading your emotions because they can't mimic your facial expressions.
A participant asks here, what do you do when people look sour but act pleasant?
But if you smile at people, they naturally smile back at you, and that can change their state.
Well, then you probably have a different problem. But even on a subtle level, they will. Like, it's not conscious.
So the next thing that I want to talk to you a little bit about is going to the doctor's office is being part of factory work. You are a widget. They have production, and they have productivity goals. Well, the time is short, and I think that one of our goals or one of our tasks when we go to the doctor is to be remarkable. Remarkable, so that you're not just another widget. One way of being remarkable is
it's
looking good. Oh my God, does somebody have a camera? Is to be remarkable. Now, when a couple of weeks ago, I was at my primary care doctor's office, and I said to the office manager, who's very cool, and she's been there forever, I told her I was coming to do this, how were people remarkable? I said, so are people remarkable because of how they look? They wear a scarf, or like me, I'm always wearing a hat, or do they bring cookies or flowers, or what makes somebody remarkable? And she said, well, you know, my staff likes that kind of stuff. But what I like is people who are decent to me. This is hard work for all of us. You know, people are sick. We're trying to help. It's just challenging. And I said, so what is in your 25 years of being an office manager, who is the most remarkable person you've ever met? And she said, oh, absolutely. She still comes here after 10 years. And every time she calls, she goes, this call will be recorded for quality purposes. And she just loves that because she can see that this woman is on the phone because her staff sits up straight. And they're immediately engaged, and they're worried, and they want to do the best job possible. And I said, do you think she's recording the call? She says, I don't care. If she does, she does. If she doesn't, she doesn't. Makes no difference to me. But she likes that the customer service that this patient gets. So in my career, both as a nurse and as a patient and a caregiver, I've made it my business to have relationships with the office staff because I personally think the quality of the care I get is directly related to my relationship with the office staff. If things happen, the portal isn't, I'm not getting what I need. I need an appointment. I need a piece of paper. I need a form, whatever. I know that they know who I am because, you know, as you can see, I'm a character. They're very responsive. So my question to you guys is how, either as a patient or a caregiver, how is it that you are remarkable?
You know, something that I try to do, even if it's just like at the coffee shop or whatever, is that connection in that you really appreciate something about the person that you're interacting with. And I mean, genuinely, you are a beautiful blue eyes. I can see the kindness in that. And I mean, it has, if you're not genuine, it's like it shows, but it gives you a chance to connect. And the next time you go into that coffee shop, it's like, oh yeah, you want your latte or whatever, and you start to build relationship.
I agree with what she said, if I would have the patience to do that. But I'm thinking of a time specifically where I go to this bank, a local bank, just for whatever. It's not a big deal, and I'm probably in a hurry. And the person always says, so what are your plans for the weekend? I mean, I don't know this person. To tell you the truth, I'm really irked.
Right.
And it's like, now, and I'm kind of a smart aleck, I say, I really don't know, what about you? You know, I mean, I don't want to talk about my plans for the weekend with you. And that's bad. Maybe that's bad. So when you said it's got to be genuine, it's got to be genuine, and it's true. And I know that this person was trained in their last in-service to ask everybody what they're doing for the weekend or what are your plans for tonight, or, you know, and they don't care.
That's right.
You know, anyway.
So that goes to the genuineness piece, what you said and what the office manager said.
It's got to be hard for them. Right. You know, it's generally a young person who probably just got the job and they're doing what they're supposed to do, but it's not, it's just clearly a rote.
Anyway.
I work with Walgreens, and we do some investigations with these kind of things, too. And we want to develop relationships with folks, and some of the things that people say that, you know, I come to your place because I trust this pharmacist. I might switch doctors, but I can ask them, and they'll tell me anything, and they're great. But the front of the store, so to speak, that might vary depending on who's managing the crowd and what they're incentivizing folks. So they're trying some things, and I'm just giving this an example for how you can be genuine or not, of tips that come up on the register screen for the, someone checking you out. And happy birthday generally seems to be okay. It's like, oh, yeah, I've been here for 4, 15, 20 years. They know it's my birthday. Thanks for acknowledging that. But it's like, oh, thanks for coming in. It's been a month since we've seen you. Wait a minute. No, they know I'm in the store. They're tracking me. There's this creepiness to it. So how do you strike that balance, I guess? And those with more data with people and how we understand them, we have to be really cognizant of, just because we can technically do it doesn't mean we should fit somebody's
Your example real life. Is from the point of view of the medical system to the patient.
Right.
I'm really interested in what we do in terms of that. Like, I know, except for my mother, who would never leave the house without her face on, caregivers and patients are not really thinking about how they look and whether they're wearing a nose or a funny hat. It's really not that often. It's about looks. Sometimes it's about looks. And, you know, as the office manager said, cookies, donuts, flowers, some people like that. But let's think about what we do, because I think it's important. It is hard to be proactive when you're a caregiver. But you're going to need them. When the shit hits the fan, you need them. And so having a relationship is important. And when you're like feeling like crap and it didn't go that well, having a relationship, there's more forgiveness. Yes.
So I am not a caregiver, but I have been on the receiving end of the care. One thing that I found with my oncologist was that she really connected with my spouse. And even though I didn't need to take him to my appointments, like, he brought a bit of levity, yes, to the situation, and he has a good sense of humor. And she also really got his sense of humor. So I started just encouraging him to come because I think she enjoys you. I think, you know, we get more attention if you if you come. But anyway.
I think that's a great strategy. I mean, I'm sort of a whatever it takes, that it's unique. The office is a different thing. So, yeah, thank you. That's great. Anybody else? What do you do? What does anybody else do? Yes.
So I was a long-distance caregiver, and I had to do a lot by phone.
Oh, yeah.
And when I would call the office, I'd always be like, hi, I'm Mary's daughter. My name is Ann. What's your name? Because I wanted to know who I was talking to in terms of following up or something. I'd be like, oh, Mom always liked you best. You know, I would just try to do something to kind of soften it, you know, when I needed them to fax something or get a renewal or something like that. So I always tried to personalize it and, you know, trying to be genuine. She didn't always like all of them best. So I tried to find something to say to them. But mostly just as much as possible, avoiding getting into a crisis situation. So, you know, if you could be proactive so that you're not putting them more burden on them, just being organized and communicating well what they needed. But as much as possible, also trying to personalize it.
Yes.
My mother and I shared the same doctor. She'd been going to him for I don't know how many years, but they were all very pleasant in the office, and I was always pleasant with them. So it got to a point when then Mom was bedbound, and I couldn't really get her out and things like that. I could call up and say, okay, mom has another UTI, because I could tell by the symptoms. And, okay, we'll call in a prescription. So it was that relationship that we had, and the fact how well the doctor knew her and knew me from how much I, you know, when I would bring her in and things like that, that I had that relationship. When she passed in August and I went in to tell them that she had passed, they took time out in between their patients to come out and speak with me. And every person in the office came out and said something to me about how wonderful she was and, you know, what a great job you did. She wouldn't have been here that long if you hadn't taken such great care. But it meant a lot then from the office staff, because I had this relationship with them,
yeah,
that, you know, the doctors came out, the nurse practitioner came out, the medical assistants, the billing department, everybody. You know, it was
That's really nice.
You know, that kind of, and it wasn't anything that I didn't have to bring them cookies. I didn't have to do anything like that. It was just not yelling at them.
Yeah.
You know, understanding where they were, what they were doing.
Like, really, if I feel like there is no building a relationship, I fire them. And I'm fortunate because I live in Boston, and there's lots of, you know, I see six specialists. And when my mom was in San Diego and saw a lot of specialists, sort of the same thing. This isn't going to work. I could fire them and find somebody else. But and when I know it's really working is when I can call up and go, I just got to tell you, I am so cranky today. It's not you. And then I do my cranky unhappiness. And they're like, okay, that's okay, honey. What can we do for you?
It would have been a whole different situation.
It would have been a whole different situation. Yeah, I think so. I mean, people can get into, they understand crankiness. And the word cranky, people like. I don't like call and say, look, I'm going to be an asshole. I'm feeling cranky. It's a good, everybody can relate to cranky.
So I wanted to contrast your situation in Boston. I'm a remote caregiver for my dad in Iowa.
Okay.
And there's not as much choice in Iowa as there is Boston.
Yes, right.
And my dad ended up remarrying in his late 70s, and so he has a new wife who's a character. And so as we talk about these roles and these hats we need to put on with these folks, it was a challenge just to start working with her, my dad's wife, and him when his dementia started kicking in and kind of going up and down. And we talked about, you know, how to broach these topics and get permissions. And there was reaction like, well, are you just trying to put us in a home? What are you going to do here? And really defensive. And so the dynamics that we're talking about can get kind of complex.
They can.
When it gets into the caregiving area, not just with physician or nurse, but family members and stakeholders and other people in the mix here. So we've worked it out, but it took a while. And putting on several metaphorical hats here was pretty critical.
So let me, that's a perfect lead into the third and last thing we're going to do. So I got the idea to do this session from the clowns at Boston Children's Hospital. So I used to lead the Patient Family Experience Initiative at Boston Children's. They have clowns that are full-time people that go room to room and procedure to procedure with the kids. And I took a class from them that was a two-day course called Reading the Room. And so Denise said, do you want to do anything? You know, I didn't want to get up there and do some traditional thing. And so I sort of wrote this up, and I was sort of shocked that she accepted this. So then I had to go back to the clowns and say, do you guys remember me? Oh, yeah, we remember you. And I need help. Okay, well, you know, what do you need? So we talked for about an hour about different things we could do. Like, they gave me the idea for the first one thing we did. But then I said, as we were leaving, I said, so if you were doing this session, what would be the one thing you'd want to get across? And they were, like, the two of them were right away, both of them. You got to find the humor and the story in failure. because we are professional entertainers and we have done this work for 20 years and we fail at it more than we're successful at it. The kid is scared of clowns. They're just like tired. The parents wish you weren't there. Or we read it wrong. It wasn't appropriate. We just have to leave the room and go, man, we messed that one up. And then we have a little funny story to tell ourselves, and we share it with our colleagues. There's six of them that are clowns. So they said what they would want to get across is that going to the doctor is a shit show. There's just no doubt. I mean, sometimes it's wonderful, but the whole experience in so many ways, obviously, caregiving is a shit show. It's heartbreaking. I think there's two things. One is being able to find the humor, tell a funny story on yourself, and then share it with your cronies. Like, that is big. For example, my son had melanoma, metastasizing melanoma. He's got his first, well, his, I don't know, I was going to say his first, but it wasn't even his second, but a round of treatment at a place in Rochester, New York. The clinician, the doctor, kept talking to me or my wife, whoever happened to be there. We just kept saying, he was 20, 24. He's the patient. And it was just so stressful. I mean, we ended up going somewhere else, but we just made a story out of it. And in a way, that was good because it was 3 months before he died, and he was writing a lot of poetry. His handwriting was awful. We decided to go to Circuit City and get a computer for him. And the brand new young salesman was trying to sell him a lifetime warranty. Well, my son just kept saying, I don't really want a lifetime warranty. And the poor guy, it was on his list of things to do, and he probably went to the in-service. And so finally he's had to say, I have brain cancer, and I'm going to die within 3 months, and I just don't need a lifetime warranty. And the poor guy was mortified. Well, we were hysterical. We were absolutely hysterical, and we just shared that with everybody. So
my mom lives in a smaller town like Pete's dad, and there's no gerontologist or geriatrician. There's very few primary care doctors. Hers isn't that great, but we're not going to get like a better one. And it is really hard, though, to recover those relationships. And so I feel like, yeah, we have some interesting stories about my mom's doctors, but we don't have any place else to go. And so I feel like we can tell ourselves those stories, but we still have to go back and deal with him. And I'm not quite sure in some cases how to start over or change the dynamic, because people remember you. And, you know, there's been harrowing situations. Sometimes he's been great, and other times really, really horrible. I don't even know where to go from there sometimes.
Well,
so it's kind of a funny story for us, or a whatever
it's for
story
you.
For us, but
yes.
We still have to go back,
yes.
And there's nobody else to go to.
Yes.
So it is, I guess, still a question in my mind about how do you, like, level set and start over or somehow shift that dynamic, because it's very hard.
I don't have an answer for you.
I know there's notes in my mom's medical record that, like, I'm a huge pain in the ass.
The best thing I ever learned from my grief counselor was that there's stress you can manage and there's stress you can't. My son was dying and died. The doctor was a jerk. That he's dying is stress you can't manage. That he's a jerk is stress that you maybe can manage. And the how you deal with it is something you definitely can manage. That was such an aha to me. Is this something I could manage myself or with somebody, with my family, with a friend, with a drink? I don't know. But I could manage. And so it really helped me in the long run to deal with all these totally can't manage to sort of can't manage things because I wasn't spending so much time on the things that I could. And so one of the things that I appreciate about this suggestion from the clowns is that things go wrong. And actually, I think probably the most important part of that is having cronies to share it with. I know that caregiving is a really lonely business. For one thing, here you've got a bunch of cronies. If you don't have cronies to share shit show stories with, exchange phone numbers and email addresses, so you've got people. But I think that's really important. I'm not solving your, I think your dilemma is so real, and your rural dilemma is so real that there's no choice. Anyway, yes, ma'am.
And I can't solve it either.
But
my husband has Alzheimer's, and 15 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, his primary care physician was bad, and we got out of that situation, but it was bad for a long time. And now, 15 years later, my husband is in a memory care facility, and lo and behold, that physician's mother is there. There's karma. I mean, there is karma. When they walked in, the physician and his wife, and I looked down the hall, and, you know, what is he going to do? Here I am sitting here with my husband, who he was horrible to, who now has Alzheimer's. I'm kind of saying, I told you so, but not really. But I handled it so well when we broke it off before. It was just a break off, and I never talked to him again. But now that his mother is there, it's a whole different situation with he and I. We're people. We're all just people. He's not the shit doctor that he was before. He's somebody's son who's in the same situation as my husband is. And what goes around comes around. And it kind of gave me a little fun feeling. But then again, his mother is one of my favorite other clients. She and I get along so well. And she comes to my husband's room all the time. I find her sleeping in his bed. It's really, it's kind of funny. If you can't laugh, you cry.
I don't know if it would work, but I wondered about your advice about the cranky. You know, just heading it right head on. You said, well, I'm really feeling cranky today, and then they got that. And then, you know, if there's something in that file that happened to confront that, I know that I haven't always maybe been the easiest, but I hope we can move past that. I mean, somehow, so you'd feel better. I don't know. That would take a certain amount of courage, but at this point.
Oh, I have a difficult not an older person that I'm caring for, but my son has obsessive compulsive disorder. And so I've had to deal with the school a lot about that. And it's not exactly the kind of thing that schools see a lot, so they don't really get it. I don't feel like I am that person, you know, because I'm not like an angry person or a frustrated person, but it's the situation that is making me frustrated. And I'm sure it's the same for you. You know, I see their principals and I interact with them and I try and do things at the school to volunteer and be active so that they know that I'm not just this one-dimensional person. But I acknowledge that they may see me as that mom, you know, because I never give up and I'm always in their face and we need to do this differently. This is what the evidence-based practice says, blah, blah, blah. Sending them research articles, they're like, I'm not going to read that. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. But you can't give up, right? So I guess I just, part of how I cope with it is just by acknowledging that I am not that person, but I am in this situation. And if they were in this situation, they would understand why I have to be this person. So I'm not feeling guilty. But I'm just acknowledging that, you know, I have to be an advocate for my child because no one else will be. Sometimes it's okay just to know that you're not that person.
Back to the humor and coping. I remember one of my friends, sadly, his mother was dying of cancer, and the doctor told them, well, she probably only has till Thursday. So there's five kids, all the grandchildren came in, they were all there, and it's Tuesday, and it's Wednesday, and it's Thursday, And it's Friday. Now the kids are starting to go crazy and they're taking them bowling and they're trying to do all this stuff. And, you know, then they'd all come back to the hospital and they're waiting. So it's Saturday. And he said, we're coming back from bowling again. And we see the doctor walking down the hall. And John says to the doctor, so when you said Thursday, did you mean next Thursday or the Thursday after that? Like, which Thursday? So they just all got such a great laugh. And, you know, that was kind of what they think about, that this time period they were all kind of stuck there together. But so humor really helped them through.
So what do you think? I've been trying to focus on the sort of the nonverbal, non-medical, managing the accoutrements, I don't know, of the challenges of going to the doctor. So whether you're chronically ill yourself or you're going with, you know, somebody you're supporting, what other things are you aware of, do you try to deal with?
Just as a simple principle, I try to be aware of reciprocity that's built into everybody. And I think someone over here mentioned it, like if you smile to them, they'll probably smile back. Even if you don't feel like smiling, it can level the situation a little bit. And just watch for cues as they're talking with you. If I'm talking with this gentleman with a hat and I match what he's doing, he knows that I'm interested because I'm mimicking his behavior. And I don't even think about it oftentimes, but if I do, people will see that and automatically go, they're taking me seriously, even though they aren't, might be thinking that. So just little things that give this back and forth, and just having those in your mind, if you need to diffuse a situation, those bodily cues might help.
Thank you. Using your body and finding the humor and sharing it with somebody. If I have a lesson here, that's them.
Keep the hat.
Keep the hat.
One of the things I think is also important with provider, family, or provider-patient encounters is also as the person who is interacting with the provider, kind of reading them to figure out, oh, if they're really angry, they might not be angry at you, but maybe they also had a bad day. And so sometimes, like when I'm in the doctor's office trying to get an appointment scheduled, like around my time, and they're really busy, and they look like they're super stressed, I'll say things like, oh, it seems like you're having a bad day. Like, how's it going? So I will also acknowledge their feelings, and sometimes that helps the situation because they realize, like, you're not just focused on yourself. And I realize that's really difficult, especially if you are also having a bad day. But it can make the situation a little bit better and then be a little bit more friendly to you as well.
That was great. I think... And it made me think of a situation when I was caring for my mom. And my mom was a diabetic. When I talk about diabetes, I talk about the personality of diabetes because everyone's experience with it is so different. And I think when you go in to see a clinician, it's not like they're jaded or cynical. They're busy and they've seen cases over and over and over and over again. And sometimes we talk, but we don't listen. And what I found was when my mom would explain what her experience was, there wasn't a lot of listening. And so I think from the opposite side, what we can start doing is acknowledging what's happening for the clinician. So I might be the 30th person they've seen before lunch. So if I can listen to how they even say hello to me, how the phone shuffles as they're picking it up, and if I hear paperwork in the background, or if I'm with them, I can tell that they're physically with me, but they're also paying attention to the 7 other patients in each room that they stick us in, right? So they stick you in this room, you wait for 20 minutes, they come in 2 minutes to check in on you. Okay, the nurse will have something for you at the desk. And I think sometimes that's what a lot of clients walk away feeling. No one heard me. And then we get into the right or wrong. I'm right about how I feel today. and you're making me feel wrong because you're not either hearing it or you're saying something that doesn't make sense to what my condition is. And I hear that now as a coach in telehealth for my clients with diabetes and cancer. My oncologist sees so many people that he doesn't hear what my experience is. And now when I go see him, before we even communicate, there's tension. So when you call on the phone, you're on your phone, there's already tension based on the conversations you've had in the past. And so I think sometimes if we just stop and intuitively listen and then respond, right, without I'm right, he's wrong, because that's what's happening. So you're in the position that you're in, and you know what you know, right? And it might even be right. And he's the doctor. I'm right. And so where do we meet? Where we take that off the table and we hear each other.
Mic drop.
So I think part of the reason why sometimes conflicts happen is it's not about the patient anymore. It's about who's right and who's wrong. And sometimes when we center it back towards, I just want the best care for whoever it is you're caring for, and how can we work together to achieve that? And like, even though you're still accomplishing the same thing as what you were doing earlier or what you're trying to do earlier, whatever it was, it can be a more pleasant experience. Not that it always works, but sometimes like reframing the logic or the thinking and reasoning behind why it is that you're acting the way you are can help the other person also understand you a little bit better too, because no one can read your mind. I make that mistake all the time with my husband. I'm like, what do you mean you don't understand this? And then we realize we just really have to, it's a lesson in communication, I suppose, and figuring out how do we reach a new understanding of each other.
And I would just, to end, I would add on to that what the clown said. They're professionals, and they fail more than half the time at it. They just say, we just got to tell a funny story and move on to ourselves and move on to the next thing because it's too heavy. So I personally like that. Well, thank you all very much. This was a different kind of keep the hats. Please keep the hats, keep the noses, keep the bead.
Okay. Lessons from the clowns. Humor, humanity, failure, reading the room. You are not alone. Thanks for your time.
Please help me maintain this ad-free blog and podcast. I appreciate your readership and your listenership. My blog and podcast will remain free to anyone who subscribes or listens. While a monthly contribution is best for me, I gratefully accept anything you can contribute. Look for the Support Health Hats blog and podcast button in the show notes and on my website. Follow my blog, podcast, and resources through my website, www.health.com. See you around the block.